Hello and welcome to the Inner Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
In today's episode, we're joined by Rosie Mutton to talk about terrorism and the role of women in terrorist networks.
Yes.
Hello, Rosie.
Hello. Thank you for having me. My thesis research examines how female participation in violent extremism varies within and between groups. So within as in women within a group, so if you take Islamic State, women, different women do different things within that group, and then between groups in the sense that when you compare across different groups, women also have different roles that they're allocated and they perform them differently. So looking at violent extremist groups, it's sort of a range of ideological perspectives and organisational structures and internal cultures. So where violence is used as a tactic to assist in achieving goals. And I'm looking at seven different case studies with five role types. So
okay, that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It ties in with a lot of the stuff that we talked about before, doesn't it, Josh, in the research network?
Yes, Technology, Terrorism and Armed Conflict in the 21st Century Research Network, which...
TTAC21.net.
Yeah, shout out for that. Which sort of led to the birth of this podcast, actually, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, because we were talking about drones and killer robots and stuff, and then eventually we thought we want to talk about other things as well.
Yeah.
And we thought we quite like chatting about stuff. So,
So what type of roles do women typically play in terrorist organisations?
So there's quite a wide range of roles. Often people think of the stereotypical ones, so mother, wife, cleaner, cook, that kind of thing. And they're sort of split into... but there's a wider range, and you can sort of split them into, or they have been split into two categories in previous research. So there's, you've got the like active roles, which are sort of ones that use violence. So if a woman's a combatant or a suicide bomber or assassin, but that also kind of covers roles where women place themselves in danger. So like intelligence gathering or logistical planner. But then you also have the more sort of supportive roles, which are often termed as passive because they don't include violence, and these are sort of fundraising, the domestic chores, bearing, raising children, and transmitting ideology, as well as recruitment. So there's like a really wide range, yes.
Okay. Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, so do the roles differ then based on the organisation itself? Because obviously when we say terrorist network, that could mean an awful lot of different things.
Yes. So there's lots of different factors that sort of determine the types of roles that women will play. So one of the main ones would be ideology.
Mm.
So in sort of the more left-wing groups, such as the Armed Forces of... Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia... they're a left-wing group, so they're based on establishing a more sort of socialist society within Colombia. So based on that, they assign a wider range of roles to women. So women in that group are able to be combatants and engage in violence, whereas if you look at a group such as Islamic State, where initially, although that has changed since it evolved, their ideology is quite, well, it is very fundamentalist and conservative. So women were assigned mother roles and the sort of traditional, if you like, roles that are associated with sort of female biology, such as having children and that kind of thing. So women in Islamic State were sort of, there were less opportunities for them to engage in those other types of roles. There's also external pressures on the group. So the roles that women are assigned does change over time. So for example, in the Tamil Tigers, after the 1983 anti-Tamil riots, a lot of the young Tamil men who would have traditionally been the main sort of recruitment pool, if you like, for the Tamil Tigers. A lot of them were either imprisoned or killed, or they migrated to sort of escape that situation. And so the Tamil Tigers then sort of revised its policies, which had been initially quite conservative towards the type of roles that women could engage with, and they allowed women to participate as combatants and as suicide bombers, which was quite out of step with the sort of traditional Tamil culture that they were trying to maintain.
I mean, when you talk about ideology, do you look at the links with religion as well, or do you separate them completely?
Yeah, look at the links with religion as well. So for... obviously, you've got the sort of the Islamist groups such as like Islamic State and Al Qaeda Central, but I'm also looking at Irish Republican Army, and Catholicism is obviously quite a big part of that, where that kind of fits in with their sort of nationalist aims, having shaped their sort of culture and their attitudes towards women.
Okay.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
So we were going to ask about implicitly gendered terrorist roles, but I think they seem more explicit rather than implicit, don't they? Or are there kind of more? Are there also sort of invisible roles as we would kind of traditionally understand it as well?
Yeah. So there's sort of I think when I'm like implicitly gendered. That's kind of, Jean Beth Elstein in 1995 says, when most of us think terrorists, we'd not see woman. So I think that's kind of how I've been thinking about gender as sort of implicit within terrorist activities, because often, and like a lot of research, it just refers to a terrorist and you sort of assume that's a man, whereas for female terrorists, they're always prefaced by their gender, so they're always the female terrorist. They're never just... Whereas it's not a male terrorist, it's just a terrorist.
Yeah, I mean, has that changed over the years, do you think? Because, I mean, I'm thinking back to maybe the 90s when I was sort of growing up and thinking, well, we would always maybe associate terrorism more with maybe like the IRA, for example, whereas in the sort of 2000s, actually you associate it more with maybe sort of the, as you say, like the Islamic States or Al-Qaeda.
Yeah,
And maybe women are becoming more prominent with sort of suicide bombers. I don't know. This is just my sense that I get.
Yeah, it sort of depends on the group.
Right.
Because I was going to say, because there was a sort of a trend in Palestinian Palestinian groups, wasn't there?
Yeah, there were. Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. So you had Leila Khaled was like the main. Like woman, that's most known associated with sort of hijacking and for Palestinian groups, and then you've also got they did deploy quite a few suicide bombers until the Tamil Tigers. They'd used the most or deployed the most female suicide bombers. So you had Wafa Idris was I think the first one. So it changes over time depending on. Sort of where the group is in terms of the wider conflict. So when a group starts out, often that's when they'll have sort of like the most resources, they'll have sort of largest membership usually. But then as the sort of conflict goes on and they face more external pressures by the state, or they lose members through death or defection, that's when they might turn to considering using women they've got a more conservative ideology.
So it's a question of numbers almost then, really, because I suppose you've got 50% of your group, like you're not using them.
Yeah, in a way, yeah. But then it's also interesting because women do achieve different things than male terrorists. So it can sometimes be strategic as well as like numerical.
Right.
So in the 1980s and 1990s with the IRA, they used to deploy women to sort of smuggle explosives and weapons through checkpoints, and what they'd do would be they would wear a synthetic pregnancy bump, so they'd appear to be pregnant,
right,
and then they wouldn't be searched by the male checkpoint attendant, because there were sort of wider sociocultural norms about, you know, not it's inappropriate for a man to, you know, invasively search a woman's body, and there was also like an assumption that, oh, she's pregnant, therefore she wouldn't do anyone any harm, the sort of like nurturing mother stereotype. So whereas obviously a man couldn't do that because that would just be really suspicious. so women do provide certain like strategic and tactical values.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff. Yeah. So obviously we've agreed that this is absolutely incredibly interesting. So how are you approaching your analysis of kind of the subject? What's your framework for analysis?
So I have developed my own framework. It is a theoretical framework of analysis because I found that most of the frameworks, there are like about four or five different frameworks that group, broadly group role categories, but they're really descriptive. So they just describe what women, they just sort of say what women do, but they don't necessarily actually tell you why and or what that achieves for the group. So my framework has three levels. It's got an individual, group and social, and then looking at it through those three levels, it's this considers various factors that inform role performance, that goes beyond just sort of categorizing the practical actions, but actually thinking about the social cultural context, the external pressures and the function of the role. And it combines Judith Butler's gender performativity theory, which I don't know if either of you have ever...
I'm well aware. Yes.
I'm a bit rusty on it, but for some of the listeners who are perhaps not quite so experienced with it, it would be good to...
Okay, so it's very complicated, but basically the way I'm using it is that... So the core premise is that gender is socially constructed performance, so there's no like gender identity behind the expression of gender. It's all fake. Gender is the existence of gender is contingent upon constituting acts which produce like a series of effects, which Butler terms as performativity. And so without these acts that she describes as performative, there would be no gender at all. So the acts of gender create the idea of gender, basically.
Mm, yeah.
Which is, yeah. But she says that in a very much longer way. So that's where I use her theory to kind of derive the four gendered mechanisms of learning. So as part of the analysis, I'm arguing that women learn their roles through these gendered ways, and they perform them in a variety of different ways related to that. And then I'm combining the Judith Butler with communities of practice approach, and that kind of conceives of learning as a situated relational social process. So it sort of, it generates social practice in the lived in world. And a community of practice is different from a generic community in that it involves a shared domain of interest. So members interact and learn together, and they develop a shared repertoire of resources. So that's kind of symbols and vocabulary and different routines that are familiar to that kind of group.
Right.
I'm conceptualizing each extremist group as a distinct community of practice.
Right.
With those symbols that they've created.
And they learn these things when they're within the group?
Yeah.
I mean, it just occurs to me. Do you look at how they learn these things outside the group first, or what maybe leads them to go from one community to sort of another to join a terrorist and sort of network to start with?
I'm not looking so much on motivations, but thinking about a kind of a power person is obviously they go into a group with an existing cultural understanding of wherever they come from. So trying to think about that, for example, like when Western women migrate to join Islamic State, their perception of what women do and how women interact with society would be very different to how Islamic State conceptualise it. Mm. So there is that kind of pre-existing difference. So part of what I'm trying to do is to think about how Islamic State have to sort of, if you like, teach these women their culture, their sort of interpretation, and sort of thinking about that through female performances of recruiter roles, where they sort of transmit those key messages to the women who are wanting to migrate over.
Right. Would you say that they're more or less successful, depending on where the woman's coming from to start with? Because I'm just thinking, because listeners might be aware of a few high-profile cases in the news of certain Western women going over there and then maybe having some regrets after, maybe after a short period of time, maybe after a long period of time. I just wondered, is that something you look at all?
Not so much, because it's more what they do when they are there.
Right.
But it is interesting to think about how, so in the Islamic State case, there are female recruiters who migrated from the West, target new recruits from the West, and then Middle Eastern women who joined target a Middle Eastern female audience. So, and the message is subtly different, or at least it was. So the sort of, there's a piece that targets Saudi Arabia, and it says, you know, to women that you're not living the correct religious life. You need to come over here to join the Islamic State to live your life like correctly and religiously. Whereas for the Western female audience, it was certainly in 2014 when it was quite new, it was sort of displayed as quite an exciting and adventure. So that difference of, oh, come over
very
here,
different,
it's very exciting. Mm. You know, we can, there's all sorts of different opportunities for you to engage with. So it was a very different narrative that was sort of targeting, depended on the target audience.
So you mentioned sort of your sort of four elements of performativity that you're looking at. So could you explain what they are and sort of why you think they're the best way to understand the role of women in terrorist groups?
Yep. So they are imitation, repetition, parody, and discipline. Yeah. And I think, well, I basically think that they're the best way to understand the role of women in terrorist organisations, because there's, as I said before, there's not very much theoretical research. So it's quite difficult to get like a systematic kind of comparative across different groups because of all the different contexts and times and geography, geographical factors. So they're basically fairly self-explanatory. So imitation is, there's an original that women are imitating when they perform their role. So often it might be, so for example, to take Islamic State again, historical figures are put forward to women and they're told to sort of emulate these figures. So that's kind of like an imitation of what those historical female figures have done. Repetition is kind of similar, but it's sort of more about repeating certain acts over and over again. So like repeating the same messages and kind of like entrenching that message. Parody, I'm thinking about this in kind of two ways. So I've got parody as the subversion of feminine norms. So that's where you've got women who outwardly they appear to be normal women being women, but they're actually using that. So with like with the example of the using a fake pregnancy bump for the IRA, they're using that to kind of achieve their specific aims for the group they're associated with. And then the second one is parody relating to sort of copying in a way masculine characteristics and behaviours. So that's kind of more to do with, you see that more in the combatant roles, because combat and war is like a very masculine arena.
Mm.
So women, in a sense, in order to be successful, they sort of have to become more manly. Not become more manly. They have to sort of almost hide their femininity and sort of give like an outward appearance of being like tough and that they can cope with the various situations that they're in when they're engaged in combat to sort of prove. There's lots of quotations from various different interviews with women who say, oh, I had to prove I was, you know, more manly than a man, and I had to prove that I deserved to sort of be in a combat role. And then discipline is thinking about it's kind of seen in the recruitment in the recruitment roles quite a bit, so sort of exerting peer pressure and sort of staying with those messages that they're repeating to sort of say, well, this is the role you need to perform, and there are consequences if you don't perform it in those boundaries.
Right, okay. That's really interesting. So, I mean, because I've done a bit of, sort of gender research myself, but not in in this area at all.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if this can then also be reflected back into the masculine side of things, and you're looking at, well, sort of masculine performance.
Yeah.
Sort of questions of masculinity, because I know there's a sort of, the sort of the types of young male recruits they tend to get in these organisations, they tend to be the sort of the outcasts, the loners, who are looking for masculine role models maybe, and this is where they find their outlet. I wonder if there's also something that could be sort of mirrored back onto the male side as well there.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. There probably could be. There's also a large assumption that men in terrorist groups are all committing violence, but they're in a similar way to the roles that women have. Men have very different roles, and there's a hierarchy, so only like the most kind of, if you like, the most committed and the sort of ones who are considered to be the best are likely to be in violent roles, whereas sort of the weaker seeming ones probably aren't perpetrating violence. They might be doing more to sort of help sustain and maintain the group, where women are excluded. So there are women aren't involved in every terrorist group. So almost in those kinds of groups, the men who would be considered to be less committed or less, not maybe as strong physically, they'd probably be fulfilling the traditionally feminine roles in a way.
Right. I mean, this then sort of opens up a question that I've been sort of thinking about the entire time we've been talking to you. It occurs to me that it leads to this question, well, what is a terrorist? And I'm just wondering as well, sort of, to what extent are these people all necessarily guilty or responsible?
Mm-hmm.
Because as you say, obviously women, you're saying women are playing important roles in these groups. But then if they're not, say, directly killing someone, to what extent are they also a terrorist? Or so if I'm part of a cell, I might be facilitating, I might be giving Josh guns, for example, to go off and do terrorist acts.
Yeah,
I think we'd probably agree that I would be implicated in the terrorism there. But obviously, there are lots of other ways people can facilitate a terrorist or a killer doing their job.
That's something I have struggled with, trying to draw that line, because without, you know, accidentally implying that everyone's a terrorist sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think, one of the things that, by looking at the different roles that aren't violent, that I'm trying to sort of draw attention to, is the fact that groups have to be sustained and maintained in order to continue existing. So it's quite difficult, because if you, for example, the IRA, I've found it quite difficult to draw the boundaries, because if, for example, you've got a mother or a woman who's got children in the IRA and she provides them house room or, you know, a safe house, does that then mean that she's implicated or not, because they're her children and she is unlikely to just turn them away? So it's quite difficult, because I think particularly in cases such as the IRA or in the Basque case, where it's more the lines between who is in the group and who is not in the group are more blurred, it's quite difficult to sort of recognise how it's not just the members themselves that do contribute to the group, but without then sort of widening it so far to sort of claim that a whole community is should be implicated for terrorist activities.
Yeah,
it's something from my sort of touch as well, because in international law there isn't an agreed upon definition of terrorism or terrorists.
Is there not?
No.
We've been doing this all this time and I never realised that.
Because, most people would sort of say a group that uses violence for political means. Well, which many people would say, okay, that's right, fair enough. But then that also implicates movements for national liberation.
Mm.
So we think about groups that say threw off their colonial oppressors. Well, the, you know, if you use that definition, they would also be terrorists.
Well, yeah, because technically Nelson Mandela's a terrorist.
Well,
was a terrorist.
Yeah,
technically
yeah,
speaking.
Exactly. This is the thing, isn't it? So yeah, it's difficult to agree a definition of what is a terrorist and what is a terrorist group. Mm. And then that's also becomes difficult of, yeah, as we were saying before, how do you define the in terms of the law of armed conflict and who's kind of targetable in the, mm-hmm. in hostilities? So how far can you go in terms of, obviously the person with the gun or the bazooka or whatever,
yeah,
that's kind of quite clear.
You can
kind of
see that.
Yeah, as we were saying before, kind of the person who gives him a bed sleeping at night or her a bed sleeping at night or whatever, you know, that's kind of a bit more of a grey area.
And you've got active and passive forms of helping people. I mean, you talk about the mother, because the mother was the example I was thinking of while you were talking, actually. And I was thinking, it's not just the fact that maybe they might have given them shelter, but it's then the fact that they don't, they're actively not making a decision to hand them in.
That
in a way is also an active decision not to act, in a way. So it's not just being passive, they're actively, proactively avoiding doing the right thing, even though they might not see it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it all gets very complicated.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating, though. That's really interesting.
I mean,
yeah,
there are also examples in Colombia, so where you have the DDR programs, which are the demobilization, de-radicalization, and rehabilitation programs, with the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, where they had problems because initially, I think it was the checking into that kind of program was dependent on you giving in your weapon. So for women who might not have played a combatant role and had therefore had no weapon, they were then sort of ignored because they didn't have a weapon to sort of symbolically hand over and say, I'm declaring an amnesty. And that's in other, not just in Colombia, there's lots of other different examples where that's not taken into account.
That's really interesting, because then obviously that prevents those women from joining.
Yeah, and they don't receive any of the sort of de-radicalization assistance or rehabilitative sort of support that those members who hand in, like men who hand in a weapon or those who have handed a weapon, then receive.
Mm. I suppose that's kind of particularly dangerous if the woman is a recruiter or a radicalizer or whatever, because if they don't have a gun to hand in, they're kind of still in their...
They could still perform their role. And that's actually something with, Islamic State. And I've talked about Islamic State a lot. But so because women are predominantly mothers, although they do have other roles, they are in charge of having children and raising them in that ideology. So actually, you can think about a mother in Islamic State performing a recruiter role in that sense. So that's why it's quite challenging to think about women who want to return to various different countries, because if you sort of just there needs to be some sort of way of kind of recognizing that it's not just being a mother, it actually has wider implications and is something that if they were proactively engaging in that kind of transmission of ideology, they could continue doing. Because again, if they don't have a weapon to hand in, they could just say, oh, I was a mother, I just had babies.
So there's a major ideological element to the sort of spread of terrorism, inverted commas, whatever terrorism may be, in that sense, I guess. I mean, just sort of to bring it all together, really. I mean, what sort of conclusions do we think we're leaning to here? I mean, obviously, take women far more seriously when it comes to terrorism, I think, which seems to be the obvious one to take away from this. But what else have you sort of found?
So that's the main one. Also, that the idea that of this whole sort of passive and active doesn't really help, because then that still leads to not taking women as seriously as they could be if you think, oh, well, they weren't involved in violence. So kind of trying to emphasize that less and sort of think about how, okay, well, the violent roles are the most damaging, but there are other underlying roles that do contribute to the maintenance of a group. And thinking about thinking about, this isn't really a conclusion, but it's something like that we've been talking about, the whole distinction between who's a member and who sort of help, sort of is associated with the group, still thinking about that sort of tension. And also that women can be deployed in certain roles for strategic purposes, and they do provide certain advantages that male terrorists can't provide. So, you know, it can be in a group's interest to deploy women in certain roles for mm-hmm. certain activities.
I was just thinking about the program Bodyguard.
Oh yes.
Because come on, spoiler for anyone, but I'm going to. Kind of at the start, the first episode, there's kind of this woman who's sort of strapped up with a bomb, and kind of it's assumed that she's a victim and she's forced into it. And the last episode kind of reveals that actually she's the bomb maker and she's mm-hmm. the mastermind behind everything. And it's kind of, I suppose that kind of puts your point about taking women in terrorist groups more seriously kind of into the public sphere.
Yeah, I mean, there was, I didn't see that, but when my mum watched
it. Oh, giving it away.
Well, no, because she told, my mum watched it, and then she was like, oh, you need to see this, and I haven't yet caught up. But yeah, so that is, that was really interesting. But then, although it brought into the public sphere the need to take women more seriously, there was like another side, and I saw quite a few debates about the portrayal of Muslim women and how, you know, why couldn't she just be portrayed as a doctor? Why are Muslim women either victims or like terrorists? Why can't they just be?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big side issue there, isn't it? Because it ties in with public concerns about, especially like sort of hijab and stuff.
I mean, there's a lot of concern about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thing a few days ago in the news about you know, whether the CIA was too white to know it's a sort of see September 11th coming. And I suppose it leads into the same issue, isn't it? Is that if we see Muslim women as one or the other, then we kind of miss and Muslim men as well, you know.
Yeah, true.
Then we kind of see everything in between, and but again, that's another kind of
that's a whole other podcast.
Another whole other issue about podcast. Kind of taking more perspectives and that kind of thing.
I suppose then it is also, you could say that thinking about like national liberation groups as well, if to think about sort of like who is a terrorist, you could sort of say, well, if one side is viewing them as terrorists because they want their freedom, and then obviously from their perception they're not terrorists because they're fighting oppressors.
I mean, again, I was watching the film Charlie Wilson's War yesterday, which is about the funding of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And at that point, they're all great because they're fighting Soviets.
Yes.
But then 10, 15 years later, or whatever long it was.
Oh no, wait a second.
Oh, actually, they're not that good when they're fighting us. So we'll spend another $1 trillion to do something. Anyway.
Yeah.
I suppose it links in the whole. Yeah, understanding of terrorism is inherently political, isn't it? And there's kind of objectivity to it.
Yeah, no, definitely. And there's, because both sides have different agendas, and it's, you know, if it's a national liberation group, it's almost in the state's interest to kind of quash that. But then obviously the national liberation group itself, it's in its interest to get its freedom. So
yeah, and to make links with other states as well, because quite often national liberation groups were oppressed within their state but had support outside of it.
Yeah, if you you know how around Belfast there's lots of wall murals on the sides of buildings. There's one for Leila Khalid, and there's several mentioning Palestinian groups and kind of showing support, and there were links between them because, you know, both were oppressed.
Yeah, well, I think sort of a few people in England particularly probably don't quite realise that the IRA is quite interested in liberation politics, isn't it? Which is probably quite surprising.
But you could say it's also embracing these things for political gain as well, maybe. Tying itself in with the Palestine, because actually maybe Palestine is quite different to Ireland. But obviously for their own political reasons they'd like to associate the two together, because they're tying themselves in with this little liberation sort of rhetoric, I guess you could say.
And I don't know what that's.
So I suppose that's another conclusion, isn't it? Understanding terrorist groups is inherently political.
Yes.
Yeah, and ultimately, I suppose, the white elephant in the room is that we're sort of implicated in these terrorist acts, as you said, Josh, from the the example in Iraq and whatever, we're sort of funding these people, and then suddenly they turn against us and our weapons are...
Well, I suppose it depends on the group and the individual group, doesn't it? But
yeah,
but it's not as
clear-cut as you might think.
It's not as clear-cut, and there's always a sort of a later implication as well.
Yeah.
I suppose it's quite ominous to it.
I mean, there's just, like, you can sort of, for certain groups, you can almost, in a way, empathise with why. So, for example, the Basque group ETA, this is not to condone terrorism at all, but you can, based on, you know, Franco's policies where he banned Basque language and culture, and he went so far as to change people's names on gravestones that were spelled way to sort of like Spanishize it. You can kind of then see, okay, yeah, you can, on one level you can understand how people might feel that turning to a terrorist group is their only option, although obviously terrorism is a bad thing.
Yeah.
But when people are put in those sort of situations where their culture and everything is,
yeah, again, I suppose it's the, because it's, most people would agree that if you're oppressed, then it's a good thing to break out from under that oppression.
Well, yeah,
then it's
define oppression.
Well, exactly, and the politics of it, and who's the oppressor, who's the fighting, and how are they fighting as well? Because I suppose one of the things that people would suggest kind of defines terrorist groups is their willingness to kill civilians.
Well, yeah, that's true, and that is obviously never sanctionable at all. That's never okay.
Hmm.
So, yeah, that is. That's
a topic for another podcast.
Yeah. Well, no, that's really interesting. That's been fascinating. Thank you very much, Rose.
Thank you for having
Thanks a lot.
Me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the In the Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit inthezonepodcast.com.